me that the time has come that we announced that our meeting would start, so I think it's appropriate that we should. I want to use this opportunity to thank Harvey Glickman for his initiative in thinking up this series of talks about American Indians and for asking me to do something about it and organize it, chance to speak, and to bring some visitors. The first visitor that I wanted to bring was our visitor of this evening, partly because he's an Indian himself, an Oneida, from Wisconsin, as you might guess from the fact that his middle name is LaFollette, and because he's had a wide experience in Indian affairs, having served a career in the Bureau of Indian Affairs in quite a number of states, including Alaska, and because he's the chief authority, being the Commissioner of Indian Affairs, who's our top official for affairs of American Indians. So he brings a lot of knowledge, authority, and a wide vision of the affairs of American Indians. I take some pride in thinking that he's my friend. I've met him a good many places now from time to time. Aberdeen, I guess, was the first time we met, perhaps. Washington, D.C. sometimes, sometimes in Juneau, Alaska, and Washington again. And so I appreciated very much that he responded to my invitation that he should come to Haverford to speak to you. Introduce Robert LaFollette Bennett, United States Commissioner of Indian Affairs.
Thank you very much. It is a pleasure to be here and to be a part of this series of lectures at Haverford, but more important to have to be talking here after having talked at several colleges during the past several months. This has indicated to me a serious interest on the part of the younger college community in Indian affairs, and we want people to be concerned about the Indian people of this country. I might start off by giving you a more or less a historical sketch of the relationship between the Indian people and the federal government as a background for the current situation and the projections toward the future. After the treaty-making period and the setting up of reservations primarily in the western part of the country, there followed as the first policy of the government the what we is now described as the forced assimilation policy, under which large areas of tribal holdings were divided up among the individual Indians, following the national homestead policies, with the view that the Indian people would respond in the same manner as the rest of the citizens of the country did to having homesteads in the western part of the United States. And this went along until about 1918 or so, when the government, still in pursuance of the forced assimilation policy, decided that when certain Indians were judged by the government to be competent to manage their affairs, where the lands had been divided among individuals, they would be issued fee patents and would be able to handle their lands. And then the next significant period in Indian history came in 1924. In 1924, Indians were made citizens of the United States and the states within which they live. So I think it's significant to remember that date, that generally Indians have not been citizens of this country for 50 years yet. And then the next major policy determination occurred in with the passage of the Indian Reorganization Act of June 18, 1934. What this act did was it stopped any further dividing of tribal lands among individual members. It also made a prohibition against tribes selling their land, and it also gave certain authorities back to tribes in terms of developing their own local self-government. The authorities that tribes had prior to that time could be extinguished by Congress, and many of them were. In the course of congressional enactments, there are some 3,500 laws in the books of the United States relating to Indians. And in the course of all of these laws, there were some inherent tribal powers taken away from tribes. Many of these powers were restored in the Indian Reorganization Act, and the powers that were not taken away were verified in giving some documentary support through this particular legislation. And this continued and still is the policy of the law of the land until 1947, when after repeated requests from Indian tribes for authority from Congress to sue the United States over alleged treaty violations and wrongful taking of lands from the Indian tribes, they might be able to get some settlement from the government. So rather than, as had been the practice, of passing acts giving courts jurisdiction to entertain suits against the United States on an individual tribal basis, in 1947, the General Indian Claims Commission Act was passed. This gave the tribes authority to sue the United States for whatever claims they thought were valid claims against the government, and given a time limit to present these claims. Over 700 of these suits were filed. About one-third of them have been finally adjudicated, and the rest are in process of adjudication. This Indian Claims Commission Act also provided opportunity for appeals from decisions of the Claims Commission to the Court of Claims of the United States and finally to the Supreme Court of the United States. The claims were predicated upon land which were taken from the tribes by agreement of the tribes, but for which the amount paid was not sufficient. And the other basis for claims were the fact that certain lands were taken from the tribes without any compensation at all. And then the third basis for claims is the mismanagement of the Indian estate by the federal government. And this was followed then by a resolution of Congress called Resolution Number 108, which stated that since the government was paying the Indians off now for these claims, and the time had come for the Indian people to be on their own, and there took place then a series of what we call termination acts based upon unilateral decision of the federal government that these tribes could manage their affairs. When these were passed by the Congress of the United States, the Indian people went into, I guess, recession or retrogression, because they felt that certain inherent rights they had were being violated through this policy of Congress. And there was a great deal of popular support developed for the Indian people and their position. And so that now the Congress of the United States has not been entertaining or acting favorably upon legislation of this kind, even upon the request of one of the major tribes of this country. This was an administrative policy, and then the next act of Congress, which is a landmark insofar as it affects Indians, was an act by which the jurisdiction, civil and criminal jurisdiction over Indian reservations could be taken by the states within which the Indian tribes were located, and several states did this, and about 6 or 7 years ago, the tribes of South Dakota succeeded in having put on a ballot, a referendum, which defeated and revoked the act of the South Dakota legislature in extending its jurisdiction, state jurisdiction over Indian property. And since then, other states have not extended their jurisdiction over Indian property. And until last year, this could be done unilaterally by the states. However, in the Civil Rights Act, Indian Civil Rights Act of 1968, there was an amendment to the effect that no state could extend its jurisdiction over Indian reservations without the consent of the tribe. And this is where, this is the position the Indian tribes have always taken ever since the this particular act of Congress was passed in about 1954. So it took them about 14 years to get the amendment through that they have strive for all these years. Now, within all of these landmarks in historical perspective, either in terms of the legislation by Congress and in terms of administrative decisions, until 1934 and very slowly since then, has any consideration been given to, you might say, Indian attitudes about all of these programs and policies. And there has been involvement of Indian people in many of these program areas. However, nobody took the time to find out what the motivation for Indian involvement was. And the most compelling motivation that Indian people have for participation is the maintenance of their own society, the maintenance of their own way of life. And they have resisted any program efforts on the part of the government which they felt would interfere with this. As a consequence, the largest tribe in the country, the Navajo tribe, which now numbers about 110,000, did not accept education until 1946. The Navajo students who went to school before 1946 were, you might say, forced to go to school, and that the Navajo tribe as a people did not accept education and voluntarily began sending their children to school as a people until 1946. So they have only been have only accepted the education program in for 22 years, all of the time feeling that the impact of education would, like so many other programs of the government, have a devastating effect on their system, on their culture. And fundamentally, there are some basic differences in the two cultural systems. The Indian cultural system is related to the American, you might say, cultural system. And these relate primarily in the areas of orientation. The cultural, dominant cultural society of this country is related, is future-oriented. The Indian cultural system is oriented to the present. And so the, regardless of what the program may be or regardless of their participation and involvement in any programs, it is looked at primarily and measured primarily from this kind of orientation in terms of what good does this do me today? Not what good will this do me 10 or 15 or 20 years from now? So this has produced some various serious conflicts in that they evaluate and approach their participation from this present orientation to the present. And in the second major area is in relation to economics. The Indian economic system is consumption economics, as distinguished from the production economic system of this country. And there was a dependence by Indian people throughout the years on nature to provide everything that they needed in the way of satisfying their basic needs of food and shelter. And whenever there was a failure of nature to provide clothing, food, and shelter, this was not looked upon or evaluated from its economic sense, but looked upon and evaluated from a spiritual sense, in that nature, which had much significant spiritual significance to Indian people, had failed to provide because of something the people had done which offended nature. And in this kind of context, they accepted the failure of crops as punishment for something that they had done, and knew that in time, after they had been punished sufficiently, that nature would again provide. And this is an entirely different concept from the production economic system of this country, where the economic condition of this country is related to its gross national product. And another area which there's always been a fundamental difference is in relation to nature itself, because nature did have this religious significance with Indian people, and that was the Indian people lived in harmony with nature while the rest of society lived in conflict with nature. And this is one of the basic reasons there was always so much hostility to Indian tribes in any of the public works projects which might happen to involve land and waters of owned by Indian people. And this was one reason why Indians are not very much attracted to the idea of engaging in such activities as mining and whatnot on their own personally, and where they personally participate. In most Indian religions, the earth, you know, was looked upon as being the mother god, and any actions taken at all was considered a desecration. And this is why they lived with nature the way it was, as against the dominant culture in this country, which lived in conflict with nature, damming up rivers and doing many of the things in an effort to provide a better life for the citizens of the country. Now, as the Indian people, evaluating all of the program efforts of the government from this kind of differences in fundamental philosophies, you might say, or fundamental cultural differences, they are now faced with the idea that if they are going to maintain their society, that they are going to have to have an economic system which will enable them to maintain their society. And this causes them to face some very, very hard decisions. And some of the considerations are some of the factors to which they have to get into consideration, upon which an economy in this country and at this time must be based, are such concepts as time. Most Indian languages don't have a word for time. And I think it's significant because it's not important to them. If it was important, they'd have a word for it. But this whole concept of time, because of their basic orientation, is such that it does not have the meaning to them in terms of economics or other activities that it does have to the rest of society. And another area is the system of work in this country, where Indian people's concept of work is work when you have to, and when you don't have to, you don't work, as against the dominant society's idea of work being you work 50 weeks a year, 5 days a week, and then you have 2 weeks vacation. They didn't believe in this system at all, because they did not have as one of their goals the acquisition of material property. And they worked long enough to acquire what they needed. And when they had acquired what they needed, they didn't work again until they had some other need, and then they'd work again. Of course, this was in conflict with the economic system of this country. And the third area in which they are giving serious consideration, and this is a fundamental factor in the development of sound economic economy, is this in the area of savings. With their orientation to the present, there is no concept about savings with Indian people, and if you go to them and say that now you have $1 million, and if you invest this at 5.5% or 6%, in 12 months you have $60,000 to spend. Well, they say, well, why wait 12 months to spend $60,000 when we got $1 million today? And this is the way the concept or the context in which they look at this. So having these fundamental differences and having gotten themselves involved with the government and others in all of these program efforts through the years, we neglected to take this into consideration to the extent that we should, and consequently, their motivations for participation were not in terms of production economics, were not in terms of all of these, were not in terms of future orientation, were not in terms of savings for the future. And as a consequence, we many of the programs have for this reason failed, even though there's been Indian involvement. The reason for the failure is the motivation of the Indian people has been considerably different than it than we had thought it was. Now, in all of these efforts to bring about this assimilation process, the leadership has been taken by the government. And there was very little opportunity for Indian leadership to function under the forced assimilation policies. However, now that the Indian leadership is becoming much more skilled and better educated, they are taking the initiative in many areas in terms of determining their own destiny. It therefore becomes incumbent upon the part of the government to create an environment in which this Indian leadership can function and in which it can flourish in helping the Indian people achieve their goals and their hopes and their aspirations. And in order to be helpful in this respect, the Bureau of Indian Affairs has recently undergone what I think is a dramatic turn, in that it is now cast in the role of being advocates in government for the Indian people, whereas up until just the last few years they were advocates to Indian people of the government, government advocates to Indian people. This role has been reversed, and the Indian people are now the Bureau of Indian Affairs is now advocates for Indian people in the executive and legislative areas of the government. An example of that is several years ago when the Bureau of Reclamation or Army Engineers wanted a public works project which would involve Indian property. It was incumbent upon the Bureau of Indian Affairs to go to the Indian people as an agent of the government. And encountered very much hostility on the part of the Indian people, because the Indian people's reaction that you are a trustee and now you're here taking our land away from us for this particular project. The change is now that if the Corps of Engineers or Bureau of Reclamation wants to go to the Indian tribes and for a public works project, which might involve Indian land or other Indian property, they have to go and negotiate with the Indian people. If the Indian people oppose the project, then we in the Bureau of Indian Affairs are in opposition to the project and fight the bureaus right within the Interior Department, Bureau of Reclamation, and also to get the Secretary of the Interior, if it's the Corps of Engineers, to take a position on behalf of the Indian people in opposition to a project of the Corps of Engineers. There will be instances, however, when the Indian tribes will be agreeable to these projects for the benefits that they will receive, and in such is the case, then at that point the Bureau of Indian Affairs' role is to see that they get as the best deal possible in this kind of situation, so that the Bureau of Indian Affairs sees its role as being an advocate for Indians in government. And we hope that in the future it will be possible for the Bureau of Indian Affairs to become a strictly professional organization. And by contractual arrangements with various tribes, transfer to them all the responsibilities for municipal services. This means that the Bureau of Indian Affairs will no longer use its funds to hire government employees to do work and provide services which the Indian people can provide themselves. And the funds then will be used to contract with Indian tribes to provide these kinds of municipal-type services throughout Indian country. We hope that this will get underway very strongly beginning the next fiscal year in July 1. We've set a goal of at least 1,000 jobs a year, and hopefully in 5 years this will amount to between 5,000 and 6,000 jobs that will be taken over will be eliminated as government responsibilities and be taken over by tribes under contractual arrangements hiring their own people. Now, along with this, because Indians have for many years lived in administered communities, we are hopeful that we can use this particular administrative device to give the Indian people control over all of the municipal facilities they have in their communities, which are now the property and under the control of the federal government. And the first step is to the contracting the services. The second step will be the submission of Indian communities and tribes of an administrative plan to the government by which they will take over the administration of these facilities. And final step after this series of experiences will be legislation to give the title to Indian communities and tribes of all of the public schools, public facilities of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, such as schools, hospitals, and utility systems, and any other kind of public facilities that should be under the control of the local government. Now, one of the big difficulties that many people have in connection with this kind of commitment to local decision-making is still the tendency not to be totally committed and to feel here again that, yes, we will make a total commitment to local decision-making by Indian people for this but not for this. Or one of the phenomena that is appearing now in society is the fact that everybody is committed to local decision-making and say and verbalize this. And one of the great dangers now is because Indian people have taken the initiative is everybody wants to rush in and help them. And if they do this, they're going to smother this initiative. And we have many people making public statements before congressional committees and in other areas through the media saying we are committed to local decision making on the Indian part of the Indian people. This should have happened a long time ago. They should have been involved in all these decision making, and so we are committed that Indian people should have local control over their schools and their communities, and we really believe in their having this control over this decision making. And after having said that for 10 or 15 minutes, they spend the next 2 hours telling the Indians what they should do. And this is a phenomenon that is appearing. And if you can read the Kennedy subcommittee hearings and any other hearings, and you'll find this on the part of many non-Indian experts who beat their chests about local decision-making for 5 or 10 minutes, then spend the next couple hours telling the Indians what they should do. Well, this to me, this is not a commitment to local decision-making. And if there is to be this commitment, it's got to be all the way. This does not mean now that the Indian people do not need help. But if you are committed to local decision-making and you have the Indian people as a people want to solve their problems, they want to solve them through their own leadership. And they know what their problems are. Nobody has to tell them about alcohol, suicides, or anything like that. And the sooner the media would quit telling them about it, they'd have more time to work on it. They know what their problems are. They want to solve them through their own leadership. And as a part of this local decision-making, they want to have the power, you might say, or they want to decide for themselves that they need the help. And they know they need it. They want to decide for themselves who they want to help them. And they want to decide for themselves under when and under what conditions they want this help. And I think that if you are committed to local decision making, that and it has to be a total commitment, and it has to be a commitment in terms of their recognition of their own problems, supporting their leadership and bringing about a solution, and helping them when they ask for it. And if everybody's going to rush in there to help them now that they're taking this initiative, then I think that also is a very subtle kind of paternalism, which many people object to on the part of government. As far as I'm concerned, there are three major problems which are facing Indian people in the future. One is the adjustment they have to make to the Civil Rights Act of 1968, particularly where these provisions run against certain guarantees that they have. As a classic example is the Pueblos of New Mexico, who have an international treaty by which they were guaranteed their form of government. Their form of government is a theocracy by which the religious leaders appoint the civil government. And the Civil Rights Act runs exactly counter to their form of government, which was guaranteed to them by international treaty. Hearings have been held in the last, I think it was last week, or week before last, with the Pueblo tribe to see what kind of accommodations to this can be made in the legislative process. This hearing was conducted by Senator Irwin of the subcommittee of the Judiciary, and I believe that they will be active in seeking making some allowances for the protection of the Pueblo form of government. Another area that is going to be of increasing impact is the urban Indian, or the Indian who has left the reservation, largely because of their great numbers, also because when they were located in these urban areas originally, because it was not fashionable or acceptable in those days to be different. They didn't try to be different. Now they have begun organizing throughout all of the urban areas, originally as social organizations to be able to get together socially. And in very recent years, this has taken on a more political overtone, so that these units are, in addition to being together socially as Indians, are together for political action. And this has reached a point where in last October, all of these groups, because of their now political motivation, met in Chicago and formed a national organization of urban Indians. And I think their impact is going to be felt in the Indian affairs and in the Indian by the Indian people who are still on the reservations. The Indian people in the urban areas have four fundamental concerns. One is their concern as Indians, and this is why they are identifying with each other. And some interesting sidelights. You can go in the Los Angeles area anytime in the summer, and if you know who the people to contact, you can get invited to a big Indian powwow in one of the city parks of Los Angeles. There's not a weekend that there isn't one. And secondly, I think it's very interesting sidelight was the fact that the Navajo Tribal Fair each year puts on as a part of its fair a Yebichai dancing contest. And this year, the Yebichai dancing contest was won by the Navajo Yebichai dancing team from Los Angeles. They beat out all the competition of the local Navajo communities. So this is some indication of how far this has gone. And in their political orientation, their first concern is that they participate in the programs of the communities in which they now live. And they are beginning to be heard in the city government and of the many agencies of government, so that whatever the resources they need as citizens of this community will be made available to them, as it is to other citizens. Up to now, they haven't expressed themselves much in this regard, but they are beginning to be quite persistent about this, and the indications are that there is a response in these communities to their requests. And the third area is they are, because everyone else is concerned about Indian affairs, they are concerned about Indian affairs generally. They want to know what is going on in Indian affairs, and this is even true of some Indian people who have been away from Indian communities 20, 30 years. They are now showing a real interest in wanting to be kept informed and feel the Bureau of Indian Affairs has an obligation to keep them informed, notwithstanding the fact that they have not been a Bureau responsibility for many years. And then the fourth area is because of their own tribal identification. This has come about because of their eligibility to participate with the other tribal members in any claims that may have been awarded to their tribe. And they are entitled to participate, but they have to document their membership with the tribes. And some of them neglected to do this over the years. So there is a concern with their own tribal identification. So these are two major areas, and the third major area is in concern with Indian young people. The Indian population, 50% of the Indian population is under 17 years of age, and the Indian young people are coming upon their society, and the Bureau of Indian Affairs very fast, very large numbers, much better educated than we were at their age, and certainly more sophisticated. This poses some very serious problems, particularly for Indian society, because there is no place for them in their society. And the reason is that culturally, girls went from child to woman, and a boy went from child to man. Now we're having many Indian young people that are neither. And as a consequence, in their whole society, where it was built upon silence among the young being a virtue, and their respect for the elderly, this is causing some very serious problems of adjustment on the part of Indian leadership, because it's my feeling, and I'm sure they share it, I've expressed to them on many occasions, they have to make a place for these young people. They have to provide them with an environment in which they can speak out on the issues, and they have to make them feel comfortable in doing this. They can't treat them as outsiders coming in and speaking out. They have to make them feel comfortable, and these young people are beginning to ask, in Indian Affairs, they're beginning to ask the question, why? And we have to answer them. And so that we need to have communication with them on a very sincere basis. We may, as indicated, we may need them to feel welcome and comfortable. We have to answer their questions, but we don't always have to agree with them. And so it is... This is a real concern on the part of the Indian people in finding a place in their society for their young people. And the young people in turn still maintain as a part of their cultural heritage this respect for the elderly, and also a respect for the inherent basic disciplines of the society, because as the young people, Indian people, should they choose to become a militant, spin off from their society and spin off alone and have no followers. And so they realize this, and they seek to bring about a solution of their problems within their tribal framework, and the tribal leadership feel a responsibility and are beginning to show evidence that they are willing to provide this framework within the Indian society for them to be heard. And I think you will find that as time goes along, there will be greater contributions on the part of young Indian people, and I think we're all in agreement, and that's the reason why they're being educated. They're being educated to make a contribution, to be helpful to their people. And these young people, as distinguished from my generation when I was going to school, is that in the whole education philosophy of the government when I was going to school was to educate you away from the Indian society. And this had reached a point until the 1930s when it was a punishable offense at a government school to speak your language, either in school or on the playground. And also, the students that were sent away from the reservations to school were sent away for 4 years in the hope that within that 4 years' time they'd forgotten everything that was Indian, all of their background, and could make a more rapid adjustment. As a consequence, since they were educated away, many of the people who could have been helpful to Indians all through the years never returned to help them. Now, there was a phrase to describe that called going back to the blanket. Now, it's with this period in history, a great many of these Indian young people who are being educated are going to return. This is their purpose, to return and help their community. And fortunately for them, it is now fashionable and acceptable to do this. And they are going to return in large numbers with a very good education, and a return to this background springing from this heritage, which is now an acceptable one. They are able to return it and bring back with them this the educational process that they have gone through, and I think that we will see an acceleration of the progress of Indian people, but still on their own terms. And I think there is room in this pluralistic society for this to take place. And so I think that we all, certainly the Indian people, do face the future with a great deal of optimism. This optimism is based upon the emergence of leadership, both young and old, and an opportunity for this leadership to flourish and function. And as far as the Indian people are concerned, I don't think that their day in our society is something which is nebulous and far off in the future. I think that their day is here. Thank you.
Don't sit down yet. I think people are going to want to ask some questions. At least I would say I do. There's a hand up back here.
Yes, sir.
In view of your latter statements, in terms of the optimism that you view for the future of Red Society, what do you view as some of the more important problems that you probably face in terms of national unity, in terms of the growing awareness within the younger generation, and seemingly picking up even more parts of a cultural past and more parts of, you know, a relevant future? How do you view these correlates in terms of the problems that might be involved or might be served?
I think the one thing that is happening with the Indian populations is because of the very nature of their, say, tribal origins and tribal existence, they looked at everything from a tribal point of view. Now there are many issues appearing on the horizon which do not affect them as tribes, but affect them as people. And as a result of this, there is this banding together on a national basis in order to face these issues which affect a Navajo in the Southwest, as well as a Ute in Utah and the Tlingit in Alaska. They begin to see these. And so there is this pulling together. Mr. Nakai, the chairman of the Navajo tribe, did call a meeting of the tribal leaders of New Mexico and Arizona not recently in terms of discussing some of these issues. And for the first time in history, all of the leaders of the Oklahoma tribes met together about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and this is a kind of a growing thing. So I think you will find in the future that they will not just be operating the Indian leadership out of a framework of their individual tribes, but out of a very strong national association, because of the fact that they see these problems now as being common issues to all of them. And I believe with this kind of organization and you might say solidarity in Indian thinking, that their voice will become more powerful as time goes on.
Yes, sir. I'm troubled by something very much, and I hope I can express this myself clearly now. It seems to me that education is really has as its basis the idea of change. And it seems to me from some of your statements that many of the Indian concepts, the basis of Indian life was on certain things about nature and about really a non-material type of existence. They wanted to be just this way. And I believe this is the way you felt when you were expressing it. Then you say what was happening when the first attempts at education of going in and trying to pull people away and the fact that they're becoming educated and changing their ways of life and they're going perhaps into the cities, and then the problem about people going back, and now I can see that this must be a very great problem when the young people now, they have as all young people, when they go to the university and so forth, they have all the answers. Well, this seems to me to be perhaps a great detriment to the whole idea of unity and what you described as sort of the Indian way of life. Now, I'm concerned about this because I was thinking of going into teaching, and I really didn't know what the problems were in regard to Indian education. But now this worries me that I would consider being part of this if I know that perhaps it's going to be somewhat destructive to the whole Indian nation. What does one do in a case like this?
Well, I think the Indian people recognize that, and this is a recognition that they probably should have made some time ago, that in order to survive as a people, they have to be educated to, you might say, even in terms of protecting their own society, they cannot protect it without education. The fact that they are educated doesn't mean that when they come back to the community that they're going to change everything completely. The fact that they are educated, they feel they'll be more helpful to the community in perpetuating many of the things that they upon which they place a value. And they come back knowing that they can help perpetuate the language and the customs because they know what they are. But at the same time, they realize that these people have to, their people have to speak English and have to participate some ways in the economy, whereas the whole attitude before was it was one or the other. And what they're looking for is how can it be both? And until they have an education, there's no way they can help their people determine how it can be both. So there's been a resistance completely on the part of the uneducated, not participating at all, as against the educated ones who went completely the other way. Now, what their aspirations are in their conversations with them is in coming back with this education that there isn't necessary that it's all of one or the other, that there can be a combination, an accommodation between both, and as they sometimes describe it, working some way out that they can hopefully achieve with the best in two worlds rather than get caught in between, as many of them are, because they don't have the education, they don't have the way to see their way clear, and so consequently they try to hang on to one or they go completely over to the other. Yes, ma'am. Well, I think the students who are coming into college out of the education they are receiving are in a much better position, a different position than they were formerly, because in the education process at the very early age, they were in effect taught that everything Indian wasn't any good if you're going to live in this society. This is no longer being taught to the young Indian person. So when he came into the educational process and thought and was told that everything in his society was not good and wouldn't help him in this society, this is when he became lost and was just floating, so to speak, without any kind of anchors of any kind. Now that the education process is developing, that there is much good and he should be proud of what he has, and he knows amongst the tribal groups, the Hopis he doesn't have to go to school and read books about himself. He knows before he gets to school what it's all about in terms of his life. And because this is looked upon as being the basis or his from which he originates and moves into the educational system, then he can acquire the knowledge that he knows he has to have. And at the same time, he doesn't have to disregard or discard these other values that he has, where formerly this was what you were taught. Now that it's no longer taught. So this means that he has this to begin with. He puts education on top of this. And so between the two, and goes back to his own people, knowing what their system is, I think he is much more effective in providing assistance to them than somebody coming out of a totally different orientation.
One of the places I remember reading Bob Bennett was out at Boulder, Colorado, at the Workshop for American Indian Affairs for college-age Indian youth, and he was speaking there, we were visiting. And I remember on one occasion, it may not have been that same occasion, but it was the same place, where one of the college-age Indian youths said, "You need an education in order to help maintain the old ways."
In other words, with an education, they can understand you. In understanding you, they know how to protect themselves, but they don't know what to protect themselves from unless they actually know you, so they know both systems now. And knowing both systems, they can make a much better accommodation than having to throw one of the systems out and get into a system which is not a part of their background. Yes, ma'am. Well, there's considerable change that needs to be made. The Bureau of Indian Affairs started bilingual education in 1940. We wrote textbooks in English and Navajo related to the environment of the Navajo youngsters. And we did this in the Sioux languages. We did this in Eskimo. And at that time, education and the politicians weren't ready for it. And we had to quit it. As a matter of fact, one state passed a law against it. Now, and so what we attempted to do in the 1940s was knock in the head, so to speak, and because we are a public agency and respond to the public, we had to cut it out. Now all of a sudden everybody's jumping on us because we're not doing it. And we tried to do it 25 years ago. Now, there are many changes being made, and if you make as a policy decision in education that you're going to do this, well, you have nothing to do with at the moment. And we do have many special projects in the development of curriculum materials, which we started in 1940 and abandoned, that we are restarting. In one sense, we are fortunate in that in 1969 and 70, we have the Indians themselves to write these books, to write this material and develop this material. But this doesn't happen overnight. And neither when you have an agency of some 14,000 people that you change attitudes overnight either. And so this is always a part, and I'm sure that I can go out into the Indian country and run upon a teacher here or there that doesn't have the message yet, same as in the public schools of this country. And they're inclined to say, well, they know Mr. Jones, he doesn't have the message. Well, we've got over 3,000 teachers, and Mr. Jones may be one of a few that don't have the message. So it's going to take a little while. But the best approach I found in connection with attitudes has been that in all of the orientation we've had with people working for the Bureau of Indian Affairs, this orientation has been an in-house sort of thing. Now the orientation has taken on two other dimensions, in that the basic orientation programs we conduct in terms of attitude with Bureau employees is in the presence of Indian leaders. And that in many times we are now using Indian leadership too to help with this orientation. And I think this is going to be very, very helpful in the orientation of Bureau employees, because the Indian people then can put the demands on the staff in terms of what they have heard themselves as being the expressed policy of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. So we don't have it today, but it's on its way in a very strong measure in terms of development of these kinds of materials, in terms of the orientation of the teachers, and in terms of the opportunity for Indian people that are now coming back to be teachers. And we have many. In 1962, we had 400 Indians in college and a scholarship program of $250,000. In 1970, or this coming school year, we'll have 4,000 in college and a $4 million scholarship program. So we're going to soon be feeling the impact of these young people as they return to the reservations in various kind of professional occupations, primarily in teaching and in health and health education. Yes, sir.
A couple of years ago, Mr. Hensel gave a talk on the degree and extent of poverty in some of the Indian tribes in the West. And I'm afraid I don't remember exactly how much about it. Could you give some idea of the general extent? I know it's a difficult thing to generalize about, of the extent of poverty and how, within the framework of the culture that the Indians desire to keep, they can maintain that culture and yet provide enough job opportunities and, you know, the degree of health that would be necessary to sustain, you know, the
in back about some 30, 35 years ago, the gap between the Indian social and economic conditions and the rest of the society was less than it is today. And the reason for this is because the way society has progressed and the way the standards have gone up in every area is against the slowness of which this has taken place in Indian country. And there are many reasons for that. Many Indian people did not know they were poor until they were told 3 or 4 years ago. And I can remember, too, when I started in the Bureau of Indian Affairs, my goal was to be the superintendent of an agency, because the salary of the superintendent of an agency with all of this responsibility was $2,900 a year. And this is below the poverty line at this time. So you have several factors. You have the fact that at one time the goal of the Bureau of Indian Affairs was to see that every Indian child got an elementary education. Now the average is over the eighth grade, about 8.4. But why haven't you solved the education problem of the Indian? Well, we haven't solved it because now you have to have almost a master's degree. So they're still behind, even though they've reached a certain goals in point of time. But as the standards continually rise, and as again the lack of participation on the Indian part of the Indian people, this gets us in some very difficult positions, because the people are saying, well, look at all of the money the Bureau of Indian Affairs is spending, when 10 years ago you were only spending that. What kind of a great big bureaucracy are you building? Well, I think this scholarship program is a case in point. We only needed $250,000 to take care of all the kids, students in college in 1962. Because we only had 400. Now we've got 4,000 and we need $4 million. That's not building bureaucracy. That's more and more participation on the part of Indian people. And for instance, in the Navajo reservation, we only need money for 13,000 students before 1946, because we could only get 10,000 in school. And we knew there were 23,000 of school age. So we only needed a little money. We only spent half the money we actually needed in terms of the potential there. So all of a sudden they all decide to go to school and we have to double our appropriation. And because of more and more participation, and this is taking place all the way across the line. Now, there is much poverty among Indians if you measure it by the $3,000 watermark. The Indian people, again, if there are going to be problems which will lift them out of poverty, are going to be concerned what effect this will have on their society. And if they feel there's too much damage to their society, they'll stay poor rather than to give up what they value more than having earnings over $3,000. And as I indicated earlier, the government provided all the leadership in terms of social and economic development. And these weren't necessarily goals of the Indian people. The leadership now is beginning to see this gap that exists between them and the rest of society, and they are taking much more initiative and leadership in trying to close this gap, and in so doing are being very, very careful of the adjustments that they will have to make for having a better economic well-being. Of course, there are other factors too, like the physical isolation of Indian communities away from the industrial growth and in many very remote areas of the country, and the lack of educational level to get skilled jobs which pay higher. And so there is this situation, but again, my optimism is based upon the fact that the Indian leadership itself sees this as a problem faced by their people, and I think that the rate of progress is going to be accelerated very much through the Indian leadership. Yes, sir.
You mentioned earlier that recently urban Negroes have been organizing for their own welfare. How much organization is there? Has there been on the part, or has there been any on the part of rural Indians? On the part of rural Indians to organize for their own welfare?
rural Indians, with the passage of the Act of June 18, 1934, were given a vehicle for organization patterned after the democratic system of government. And so they've had this kind of organization. As I've indicated earlier, they've been more or less concerned with local problems of their particular tribes. They also formed a National Congress of American Indians, which is the present National Indian Organization, and it has an office in Washington. And here again, there wasn't too much real aggressive political action even on the part of this organization. However, because they are beginning to feel the pressures of Indians and that they no longer can be a, quote, social kind of organization, have to get more heavily involved in political activity. The big issue is now in terms of the Indian groups, whether they are going to remain the vehicle for this or whether the Indian leadership is going to form another national organization of their own, which they hope will be more representative and more, maybe even more responsive. But the National Congress of American Indians is the national Indian organization at the present time. Yes, sir.
Aside from whatever might be the technical capabilities of the Bureau of Indian Affairs to deal with Indian problems, a lot of recent developments have raised the question that there may be with the Bureau kind of a credibility gap and possibly the political.
just so much doubt and confusion. I think of the time when the United States Public Health Service took over Indian Health from the Bureau, and Indian Health improved rapidly, probably only because under Public Health Service, Indians were able to get increased commitment of resources to health services, not because of any inherent capability of Public Health Service, but the fact that a different organization took over. I think of another example in your own case. I heard you speak 2 years ago in the Yakima, to the Yakima tribe, in 1967. And you told them what sounded to me like a keep cool line. The argument was around political activity. And you stressed to them the dignity, quiet pace, self-containment of American Indian. And now you speak of the advocate role of the Bureau. I just wonder if these switches and contradictions make the BIA a political liability at this point for the American Indian, and if maybe for that reason alone, another agency ought to take over these responsibilities.
Well, as a part of the political, you might say, phenomena these days, you see in the problems that are inherent, the problems that exist with all people, there is no visible target except for the problems of Indian people. There's the Bureau of Indian Affairs. The Bureau of Indian Affairs has always been the visible target for all the problems of people. The other problems are based on society. Well, who's society? You know, let's transfer society. You can't transfer society. Society is made up of many things, but you can transfer the Bureau of Indian Affairs. See, they're a visible target. And I'm with the Indians on this. It's up to them. And then again, this is a part of your commitment. You can't say that Indian people should have the decision-making, local decision-making, control their own destiny, and then say, I think it'd be a good idea if we transferred your Bureau over here. Let them decide. Because they can get us transferred and they can get us abolished if they want to. So I think this is a decision that should be left to them. And if they were to say, as a people, that we want to be in this department or in the other department, I'd be very just as aggressive in helping them do that as helping them do anything else. And the statements I made in terms of the Yakima people is in terms of the expressed wishes of the Indian leadership. This is the way they wanted their problems handled. And this is why, as a people, they don't support any other method of handling their problems. And so there is this feeling among them that with the Bureau of Indian Affairs being an advocate and with all of the other resources that are available to them, they can achieve what are their goals and their aspirations through their own leadership and within their own terms, which may be different from the goals and aspirations of other groups. And so this is the way they're operating at the present time. I don't know what the future holds, and I have an idea what it might be if if we are not responsive. And so in terms of, it's another phenomenon too that happens. If you watch every commission, or Senate committee, or House committee that is set up to look into the problems of people, whether it's hunger or anything else, lack of training, lack of jobs, the first recommendation is we need to infuse more money into these programs. We need to get millions, they're talking about millions of dollars to improve the nutrition of people. Millions of dollars for training. These same committees and groups look at Indian Affairs. What do they recommend? Transfer the Bureau. And I say that if transferring the Bureau will build more schools, will provide them with better nutrition, better health, and everything they need, I would reorganize the Bureau. I would reorganize the Bureau every day of the week and twice on Sunday. So you just watch in what happens when these various commissions and go about the land on the problems of the people. We need to infuse millions and millions of dollars. They look at the Indian problem, they come back and say, we need to reorganize the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And as far as I'm concerned, if the Indian people, as a people, want the Bureau of Indian Affairs abolished, if they want it transferred, or what? This is commitment. This is my commitment. I'll work just as hard in abolishing the Bureau. I'll work just as hard on transferring it. And if they want to keep it, I'll work just as hard in trying to make it responsive to their needs.
What is the attitude of the leadership towards the Bureau of Indian Affairs at the moment?
At the moment, because of so many things that that are going on in the world and in this country, the relationship between the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Indian leadership is, I think, as good as it's ever been. And this is not a static thing. I mean, this isn't anything that the Bureau of Indian Affairs can rest upon, because there are continuing needs that have to be met, and there are ways in which the Indian people, as I mentioned earlier, through their own leadership, want them met. And if we can't, they're looking for us to respond and hope that we will be responsive to them. And we are trying to make some real sincere efforts in this direction. And we just concluded a meeting of 200 to about 250 Indian people from all over the country in Ogden, Utah, on education. This is to get the contributions of Indian people as to what they think the education program for their children should be. This is one area in which we have moved in getting their contribution in the decision-making with reference to education. Speaking of Yakima, I appointed a new superintendent for their agency about 2 months ago after he was interviewed by the Yakima Tribal Council. And this is going to be a trend that we don't send somebody out to be the commissioner's representative in an Indian reservation unless that person is acceptable to the Indian community. This is another step in that direction. So once this step is taken, or once the policy decision is made, nothing changes overnight. But these are indications of the direction that the Bureau is moving. We're moving in this direction because the Indian people want us to move in this direction. And most of the criticism of the Bureau of Indian Affairs is not by the Indian leadership, primarily by non-Indians. Well, there are several projects that we were successful in stopping at the request of the Indian people. One was the elevation of the American Falls Dam on the Fort Hall Reservation, which would have flooded some of the best land of the Shoshones and Bannocks tribes there, and getting a commitment from the political leadership in Congress that they would support the Indian people in this. We are now engaged in what is known as the Round Valley Reservation in California, where we have allied ourselves with the Indian people against a proposal of a Bureau of Reclamation dam, which would flood this particular valley, which is now inhabited by Indian communities. When it comes to the Alaska situation, of course, this is an expression, a horse of another color. The reason for that is there has to be a political settlement of the rights of the native peoples of Alaska, because under the treaty with Russia, they were acquired as chattels along with the land. And the only right that the natives of Alaska have in land of Alaska is the right that Congress says they have. Congress in 100 years has never said what their rights are. So in order to have a settlement on the basis of rights, first of all, Congress would have to pass a law telling them what their rights were. After Congress passed a law saying what their rights were, then they could go to the government and try to get settlement of these rights. Now, if they proceeded on that basis, that might take 50 or 100 years. So the leadership of the Native peoples of Alaska, the Alaska Federation of Natives, and others have gone to the government and said, okay, let's make a deal. We want so much land, we want so much money, and we want a certain percentage of your income from all of this oil business. And so this is what it will be going on now in Congress, and hearings will be held before the Senate Committee on Interior and Insular Affairs on the 29th and 30th of this month, next week, on this, because if they were to go into a strictly legal settlement based on rights through the courts, they'd sit there for another 50, 60, 70 years. So their preference also is, well, let's make a settlement. Let's not go through all of this. Let's make a settlement. We want so much land. We want so much money. We want to manage whatever we receive ourselves. And we want the percentage of the income.
Would you repeat the name of the committee, please?
It's the Senate Interior and Insular Affairs Committee. It's Senator Mr. Jackson, Henry Jackson of Washington, is the chairman. And the on that committee, that the two senators from Alaska on the committee, Ted Stevens, the Republican side, and Mr. Gravel, Senator Gravel, on the Democratic side. And as you know, the Secretary of the Interior comes from Alaska, too. Only he has a very difficult position because he was on the side of the state. Now he's got to be on the side of the natives. But I think this is the formula that's going to be followed. The question is how much. It's not a question of whether they get money, whether they get land, or whether they get this participation income. The question is how much money and how much land. So this will have to work out with the Congress. We in the government have established what we call a minimum. We are saying it should not be less than this amount, and whatever you want to give them over that, we're for. But it should not be less than so much land, should be not less than so much money, and we endorse their handling of it, and should be a certain percentage of the receipts.
If I can monopolize your time just 1 second longer, is there any way that you see that people who are not connected with the oil industry and have themselves their own personal power can bring to bear pressure to achieve a more equitable settlement than might otherwise be done? Where would you see the writing letters?
I think one of the things would be to
as the publicity develops on these hearings, is to write to the Alaska Federation of Natives, and they'll probably have a Washington office address. And they're incidentally, hopefully, will retain former Justice Goldberg as their attorney in this particular effort. Yes, sir.
This is a summary question on the politics of Europe. I wonder if you could characterize where do you marshal your support? What are the interests that are useful for the Bureau in putting together support for the program? And what are the interests that oppose you? Where's the opposition? How can we, cut through this by knowing what the basis of the difficulties that arise?
Well, there are several, as you know, Indian interest organizations, and these are the Association of American Indian Affairs, the Indian Rights Association, the Friends Service Committee, the Arrow Incorporated, and the National Council of Churches, and some of the church denominations, as well as the National Council, some conservationists, some conservationist organizations, and then there are a lot of state commissions on Indian affairs in the several states, the Indian organizations, the National Congress of American Indians, and the tribes themselves, and also tribal attorneys. Most of the tribes that are of any size or of any property of any consequence have attorneys, and most of them have Washington offices or partners in Washington. These are some of the areas, besides some very friendly congressmen and senators. And I think one of the real friendly ones is Congressman Haley of Florida, who's chairman of the Subcommittee on Indian Affairs and doesn't have one Indian in his district. But he has, by seniority, gotten to this position of being chairman of the Subcommittee on Indian Affairs, and is one of the best friends that the Indians have in Congress. He's very well supported by Senator Aspinall of Colorado, who does have some Ute Indian tribes in his district. Mr. Aspinall is very knowledgeable on Indians. Mr. Edmondson of Oklahoma, of course, is very knowledgeable and very supportive of Indian people, since he, I believe, has more Indians in his district than any congressman in the country, in Congress. And Senator McGovern, chairman of the Subcommittee on Indian Affairs in the Senate, is very friendly. Congressman Ben Rifle, who's an Indian himself from South Dakota, of course, is very friendly. He does not sit on the policy committees in relation to Indians. He sits on the Appropriations Committee. This is where he's making his contribution as a ranking minority member of the Subcommittee on Interior Appropriations. Julia Butler Hansen is the chairman of this committee, very friendly to Indians, has a large Indian constituency in her district in the state of Washington. Senator Hansen of Wyoming, and many, there are many individual congressmen and senators are very friendly. And against this, of course, you do have arrayed some competitors in the economic area. For instance, when efforts are made for Indian people to get into the lumber business themselves, they may get the competition from the established industry. We get competition from the National Association of Manufacturers when we know the National Association of Contract Building Contractors, when we attempt to build large buildings using all Indian labor. While I say we do run into this, with the support we have, we've been particularly successful, I think. And
there's also a tendency that since these committees that I talked to you about legislate with reference to the public lands of this country, there's a tendency to carry over this philosophy of Indian lands, which are private lands. And we have to really be very aggressive in terms of getting better returns for Indians out of their lands than the government gets out of its lands, in terms of the national policy and public lands as against the private lands of Indians. And there are some differences in philosophy which make it difficult between the Senate and House committees who work on substantive Indian legislation. And this is something they have to iron out, but it's no fun being caught between. Yes, sir.
This may appear to be a bit of a digression, but in terms of the private lands that you speak of, I am assuming that you're speaking of the reservation. Okay. I'd like to know what are some of the legal restrictions and provisions that are presently in operation in terms of the reservation.
The individual owners can use their land, and the tribes can use their land without any restriction. The restrictions come about when the property owners place an encumbrance against their lands, such as individuals who wish to sell their lands or who wish to mortgage their lands. This can only be done with the approval of the trustee. And with the tribes, by law, are prohibited from selling their lands. And if any leases are made of their land, which is an encumbrance upon the land, this has to be approved. Sales of timber, sales of minerals, oil and gas leases have to be approved by the trustee. And so these are some of the conditions in the trusteeship which exists over Indian property.
And no restrictions in terms of human bondage?
No. Indian people are free to come and go since 1924. Up until 1924, they used to have to get passes to leave the reservation. But from 1924, they're full citizens of the United States and the states within which they reside.
Approximately how much land is this encompass, the private land that exists?
2% of the land in the United States are owned by 600,000 Indians. And one of the traditional roles of the trustee was the feeling that he needed to protect these lands. So as a consequence, their property has been overprotected, and they have not received the full income and the full return that at least these properties could provide for them. And this attitude and policy has been changed, so there now is beginning to be a maximum development of these resources, which brings in a greater economic return to the owners, still following sound basic conservation. But the emphasis is on development now rather than on protection. And the government's going to pay through these cases for overprotecting the land because of the fact that as an example, the timber was allowed to become overmature and fall over, and these kinds of conditions existed. And so with this idea of development of Indian resources rather than overprotection, it's going to provide a greater economic return to the Indian owners than it has in the past. Well, thank you. You've been a wonderful audience. It's been a real pleasure to be here with you.
Yes, I sure do. I'm interested in the subsidiary.
Understand we have a Hartford graduate who was in Billings, Montana.
Billings,
Montana. Would it be?
I don't hold that against him.
That he's a Hartford graduate, or that he's in Billings, Montana. Would it make any sense to address a letter, for instance, to him? And